So 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and we're going to be reading this morning verses 2 through 16. I praise you for remembering me in everything and for holding to the traditions just as I pass them on to you. But I want you to realize the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is the same as having her head shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, she might as well have her hair cut off. But if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, then she should cover her head. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. It is for this reason that a woman ought to have authority over her own head because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as woman came from man, so also man is born of woman. But everything comes from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a disgrace to him, but that if a woman has long hair, it is her glory? For long hair is given to her as a covering. If anyone wants to be contentious about this, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. May God bless the reading of his word. You may be seated. So you're thinking, what's he gonna do with this? Well, welcome to one of the most confusing, complex, uncertain, and even hotly debated passages in all of Scripture. And I've titled this morning's message, Hairdos in the House of God. The witness of our worship. This text is kind of a, you know, preacher's worst nightmare in a way, where I have, you know, just a little bit of time to somehow explain and hopefully make some practical application to a very convoluted passage. But I guess that's my punishment for not preaching for the last 6 weeks, is that I get this text. But here's my goal for this morning, is to make this passage and its application really as simple as possible by focusing on what I think are the big ideas here. I assume that you don't want a message on the 12 possible meanings of because of the angels in verse 10. Just the fact that there are 12 possible meanings should tell us that we don't really know what it means, right? Although I have my opinion. There are whole books written on just this passage. Here's one here by Lucy Papiat called Unveiling Paul's Women, Making Sense of 1 Corinthians 11, 2 through 16. Paul's thoughts here are complicated. And, you know, there's some unclear terminology, which is why one very respected commentator calls the whole passage just fraught with uncertainty. Therefore, I want to stay kind of big picture as much as possible while still giving us a few juicy tidbits that might quench our curiosity about some of the things Paul wrote. But we should approach this passage humbly. Right? There's a lot of mystery here. We don't know exactly what caused Paul to address this subject matter with the church in Corinth. So the best approach is to focus on the big ideas and the lasting significance of some of what Paul says here. And what are those, then, in 1 Corinthians 11? What are the main ideas and takeaways from this passage that still hold meaning for us today, that apply to our lives? So as a way of teaching through this passage, I want to focus on these three kind of big ideas that I think are important from this passage, because the Lord did leave it for us to wrestle with. And number one is that if you distract, you detract. This passage and really the next four chapters of 1 Corinthians are mostly about dealing with distractions in the church that are detracting from the worship service. If we had to simply summarize Paul's advice here in the scriptural principle, I would say it's this: don't detract from the worship of God and the witness of the church by doing something that would be deemed a distraction in our current culture. How are some of the Corinthian believers detracting from the witness of the gospel and distracting from the worship service? Well, apparently, what they were or were not doing with their hair was becoming a distraction. It was causing problems. Now, that all seems kind of silly and irrelevant to us. It doesn't matter in our culture if a man or woman has short hair or long hair or chooses to uncover or cover their hair or head. But in the Corinthian context, understand, it was a big deal. Why? Well, there's several reasons, but mostly, remember in the introduction we said that Corinth, you know, was just a sex-crazed culture, famous for its prostitutes and its temples that were dedicated to sex gods. It was kind of the sin city of the day, right? And an uncovered head for a woman or her hair being let down in that culture was often a sign of availability for prostitution. And so Paul says, verse 13, you know, it's not proper for a woman to pray to God in a public service with her hair down, because it could be a distraction or send the wrong message to the culture around them, which would associate that, especially in the context of a temple to a god, they would associate that with other behaviors. See, it's not that God has some preference for, you know, women or men to have short or long hair. It's that some of these things could detract from the witness of the gospel, specifically in the city of Corinth. In the first century, it was certainly common custom for men to have short hair and women to have long hair. That's no longer the case. So the specific advice no longer applies. And even Paul clearly says in verse 6, you know, only if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, then she should cover her head, you know, which would imply if not, then it's not a big deal. Only if it that still remains the case. So the principle here is pretty simple, and it's one that Paul has already introduced just right before this, and this is what ties this passage together with what happens at the end of chapter 10, verses 31 to 33, where Paul says, "So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God." Remember, we called this approach the good of others for the glory of God. Paul is concerned about the witness of the church to the surrounding culture that they find themselves in and how their behavior, even their apparel and their appearance in this case, might detract potentially from reaching their community. Remember, we said in part one of our series, Paul thinks about the gospel in everything he does, in everything he says, and in every decision he makes, and he wants the Corinthians to do the same. So the application for each culture in different times and places would be to discern, well, for us, what actions or behaviors, or speech are honorable and proper or improper to the surrounding culture and don't detract or distract from the worship service or the witness of the gospel, but rather make the gospel attractive to the surrounding culture. So we might ask the question, you know, what might be misunderstood or confusing or distracting to our culture if they come into a worship service? So for example, a closely related application to the specific topic of the text would be if you came here into this worship service, you know, handing out cards to your Tinder account. That's a dating app, for those of you who don't know. It has a thumbprint, Paul. If you came in passing out cards to your Tinder account, basically saying, "Hey, everybody, just so you know, I'm available, call me," that would be wildly inappropriate for a worship service, right? Where you're just using it to tell people that you're available. And that's what the kind of things that Paul is addressing, things that would look disrespectful or would distract from the purpose of the worshiping church, that are about something other than the gospel. So, you know, hair length no longer would be a distraction or look disrespectful to a non-Christian who walks into here, right? So what would be? What are some more contemporary equivalents? Well, what if I got up here and people noticed that I was wearing $2,000 shoes and, you know, $5,000 of designer apparel? Just so you know, I got this shirt and these pants at the thrift store in August while I was on holiday, just in case. Or I had a $5,000 watch on, huge diamond earrings, and then after the service, I got in my $100,000 car. I think Paul would say that's distracting, even possibly dishonoring to God, to draw attention to yourself like that. It might alienate or confuse an unbeliever who would walk in here and wonder, what are we all about as a community? And what do we value? Right? They might get the wrong idea. But it doesn't have to be that blatant. Perhaps, you know, you're a believer in Jesus. You're a worshiper of God, and you know, but you regularly just come in really late on a Sunday. You casually sit in the back, mostly scroll through your phone. You're kind of updating your Instagram account as the service goes on. You're sipping your coffee. You're in and out. You're not really paying attention to what's going on. What does that say to somebody who walks in here and sees the holy activity of worshiping God that is taking place? What kind of message does it send about what we think is important, about what we value? How does that reflect on the gospel and how seriously we take it to someone? Or maybe you come in and, you know, are drawing attention to yourself in a way that distracts and detracts. For example, you know, a long time ago when we were a very small church, just of about 40, 45 people, we had this person who would come visit in the summer on holiday, and she was the tambourine lady. And she played her tambourine really, really loud in the service. And, you know, there's place for that, and I'm okay with that in a lot of circumstances. But in this case, it was just very, very distracting in such a small gathering of people. And if an unbeliever walked in, it would have been kind of awkward or distracting for a new person. And it kind of drawed attention not to the worship of God, but a little bit more instead to that person. Or if you come in, you know, with a huge political message on your T-shirt, or we're passing out pamphlets about something, or, you know, parked your car out front with a bunch of posters about controversial matters, or we're in here promoting your business, right? Those things would be a distraction and something that draws our attention away from the worship of God and ultimately might be misinterpreted or misunderstood by our surrounding culture. That's the stuff that Paul has in mind here, propriety in public worship. But despite Paul's advice that we should not distract in worship in a way that detracts from the gospel, that we should be sensitive and aware of the customs of the culture around us when we worship, that doesn't mean that Paul doesn't say that we shouldn't sometimes actually subvert the culture and go against the customs of the culture around us, which he actually does here, which brings us to the second principle or takeaway from this text, which is that Paul in the church of Corinth values equal voice and opportunity in the church. And we're particularly talking about men and women here, about gender equality. Some people, I think, completely miss the prophetic nature of this passage, sometimes even interpreting it opposite the way I'm going to suggest here. I'll briefly go back to verse 3 because that's where people get confused, where Paul says, "But I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God." So we already did an entire teaching, and perhaps, in fact, kind of two, where we unpack the idea of what this Greek word kephale, which gets translated head here, means in the Bible in the ancient world. So back in October 2023, so if you go to the messages page on our website, or you just scan this QR code here, that will take you to the teachings on that, and the first one will have a link to the second one, and also we uploaded all the slides from that message, because a lot of people wanted to review that and view that. But that explains what this term means or would have meant in the ancient context. But I'll just summarize here that the word kephale, translated head, means, you know, more source or origin than it does kind of authority or superiority. So in contemporary terms, we think of it more as headwaters, right? The source or origin of something, rather than, you know, head honcho, like the boss of something. And there are a number of clues in the text, including God being called the head of Christ, that tell us the meaning here can't possibly be authority or leader or superiority, because that would be heresy. But as is our purpose, I want to focus on the bigger idea here, which is this. In the first century, women were widely considered to be inferior to men in almost every culture and every place around the world. Furthermore, in both pagan and Jewish places of worship, women were completely excluded from public worship and relegated to silence, and quite often an entire separate section or balcony as observers, sort of treated as second-class people. So it speaks volumes that in a passage where Paul is clearly worried about the church not embarrassing itself to the surrounding culture, about not doing things that would be a distraction according to the surrounding customs of the day, that he promotes here the public ministry of women in church gatherings and their full equality with men. I mean, for someone who has been teaching the Corinthians, do not cause anyone around you to stumble when it comes to kind of gray areas or neutral areas or practices or behaviors. For someone who's worried about what certain hairstyles might communicate to non-believers, I mean, it's downright kind of scandalous and amazing and extremely telling that when it comes to gender equality in the church, an unpopular view in the first century culture to both Jews and Greeks, that Paul presses the issue and very much accepts and assumes that women will pray and prophesy and play a prominent role in public worship gatherings. It's very easy to miss that in our modern context. His concern is just whether they're about their hair and whether their head is covered or uncovered, but not about their actual actions. And even Paul dismantles the normal hierarchy and authority structures of the day when he says in verses 10 through 12, you know, it's for this reason that a woman ought to have authority over her own head. So that's a pretty strong statement that you wouldn't find in the first century. He says, nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as woman came from man, some people would use that as an argument for superiority, Paul says, well, no, man is also born of woman, you know, but everything comes from God. Right? He says the first woman came from a man, but that doesn't give men any advantage or superiority, because after that, all men were born of women, right? Neither sex can claim authority or superiority over the other. So Paul's advice was, you know, simultaneously very pragmatic to the church in Corinth, but also very prophetic in what he was saying. And in verse 10, Paul, you know, conceded that women have the freedom to do whatever they want with their head and hair, but as has been his advice throughout the whole letter, he's advising that we make our decisions out of love for others and have a witness for the gospel. So covering the head hair is probably best in the Corinthian context, even if it doesn't apply specifically directly to us. But don't overlook the obvious here, that Paul was expecting women to be equally ministering in public. In fact, in verses 4 through 7 about this, you know, proper attire and fashion and speaking in public worship, you know, by word count in the Greek, Paul actually spends slightly more words addressing the women and their speech in the church than men. I mean, if women weren't supposed to be leading in the public worship gathering, as some still believe today, then why would Paul waste his time telling them how to do it, right? Paul's consistent advice in 1 Corinthians is that there is no place for feelings of superiority. We've seen this previously in the letter, in the kingdom of God, whether that's men over women, free over slave, Jew over Greek, rich over poor, abled over disabled, mentally strong versus the mentally struggling. All attitudes of hierarchy or superiority have no place on the level ground of God's kingdom. And we should be expending energy and effort to make that a reality. Which brings us to our third and kind of concluding point or takeaway from this passage, which is this, you know, that we worship together and the way we worship together really matters. Our title for part two of these chapters of 1 Corinthians, part two of our series this fall, the title is Worship Matters for all these messages, which has, you know, a double meaning, of course. It's about matters pertaining to worship, but it's also that worship really matters and should matter to us. These chapters are about the way we worship, including how we approach the Lord's Supper, as is next week's text. But a big picture takeaway that could get lost is that Paul in the Bible is assuming that we worship together. I can't emphasize this point enough, right? That Paul is not writing this letter to individual Christians or believers who are just living their lives apart from the church. Paul spends pretty much the whole letter dealing with these corporate issues, these relationships within the body, because that's where we work out our theology, and that's how we worship. Neither people in Corinth nor Paul would recognize the idea of a Christian who isn't a part of and doesn't regularly gather with or identify with the church. We don't have a New Testament. We don't learn all these things about God and how God works and wants us to live without the gathered church. And not gathering together would slowly kill the witness of the church, just like it would have in Corinth. I mean, there would be no Alpha, no place for people who don't know where to turn in their desperation, no place for people to be freed or encouraged or delivered, no place for missionaries to come and raise awareness of the things they're doing, no Arrington breakfast program where we're out there every day feeding kids, no good food program where we bless our community, you know, no call from the care home down the street to call and say, hey, can you come do a service for our lonely residents who want to worship but can't get out? And when you're disengaged from God's gathered people, the church, you're essentially asking or hoping that everyone else will do the right thing and gather in order to keep the local witness of God's kingdom going. But that's kind of selfish or prideful, essentially saying, that's great that you're doing that, but I don't really need that. I just look at all the transformed lives and families and testimonies here at Oceanside. So many stories, and they almost all start with an invitation into the gathered community. It's a poor witness to the gospel, and it really puts people's souls and eternity at stake. If someone says, hey, where can I find faith? Where can I find hope? Where can I find transformation? What do you do as a Christian? And we have nowhere to point to except ourselves. Paul's words here and advice in 1 Corinthians can only come from and be worked out and applied to the gathered worshiping community. So friends, the church in Corinthians, it was messy. But you know what? You got to give them credit. They kept trying. They kept trying to figure this out, about what they should do and how they can be most effective for the gospel. You know, Paul's not like, hey guys, your church is a mess. You should really just take a break. You should kind of just be in your personal homes. You know, let's not deal with this mess. Let's keep it safe, guys. Let's just kind of worship on our own and try to, no. He says, hey, you got a lot of problems going on there, but let's figure this out together and let's continue to strive to be who God calls us to be. So the witness of worship encourages us to gather together, to strive for equality and public voice and opportunity, and to be sure we're not being a distraction and detracting from the witness of the church. So we're going to practice some of that a little right now in our monthly Sunday soak service. The band's going to come, and it's still a little early because we like to leave some extra time on these Sundays, and we kind of title this an extended time of enjoying God's presence in worship, prayer, and reflection. And the implication, of course, is that we're doing this together. We're not like, hey, go home and spend some extended time. No, there's something significant about just being among the people of God and doing this. And you can do a lot of things. You can be still. You can just soak in God's presence and His love for you. You can journal. You can read. You can reflect. You can think about today's message. You can receive prayer. So I'm going to ask our prayer teams to come up. There'll be one in this corner, one on that corner, and they would love to pray with you during this time. There's lots of time. They'll go as long as needed to pray for you. Maybe you want to pray with someone around you. Maybe you want to spend some time just praying for our world and community, just in intercessory prayer, if that's part of your calling. There's lots that can happen during this time. And if you can't stay, we just ask that you move all casual conversation to the lobby and leave this as a protected space for those who would like to just stay and soak in God's presence. If you have kids in the kids' ministry, they do still have more time, so you're welcome to stay for a few songs, but then eventually one parent, please pick them up. You won't want to miss next week as we do one of the most important things we're called to do as the gathered people of God, which is share in the Lord's table, the Lord's Supper, together. So that's next week, and that's what our text is about. So we'll see you then, but for now, I encourage you to dedicate yourself to a life that says, let everything I do, let everything I say, let every decision I make, big and small, be all about the good of the church, the good of others, and the glory of God, advancing the gospel and making it attractive in all I do and all I say. Amen. And have a great week for now. You can stay if you'd like and soak in the presence of God together.